Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, August 2nd. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a staff writer at Slate. And joining me from New York for the very first time on the podcast is Slate editorial assistant Rachel Hampton. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, happy to be here.
And returning for her second time on the show is Brianna Joy Gray, who is a senior politics editor at The Intercept, contributing editor at Current Affairs, and co-host of the podcast SWOTY, or Someone's Wrong on the Internet. She's a very busy woman, and we're happy to have her this morning. Welcome back, Brianna.
Thank you so much.
So in today's episode, we're going to start by talking about Sorry to Bother You, a Boots Riley film featuring telemarketing, capitalist exploitation, and some really cool earrings. Then we're going to discuss motherhood in the age of fear, when bystanders call the cops on moms who leave their kids in the car while they run into the store. And finally, we'll discuss how people, particularly Black women, are grappling with the murder of Nia Wilson, an 18-year-old Black girl who was recently killed in an Oakland public transit station. Then in our Slate Plus segment, where we take a topic and rate it from 1 to 10 on how sexist it is, we'll decide, is it sexist to make fun of two women on a ridiculous viral wedding email thread? If you're not a Slate Plus member yet, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/thewavesplus. All right, let's get into our first topic. Sorry to Bother You. It's a sci-fi comedy written and directed by Boots Riley. It hit theaters at the beginning of June. It stars the brilliant Lakeith Stanfield of Atlanta and Get Out as a telemarketer who becomes really successful partially on the verisimilitude of his white voice. And he is soon promoted from selling encyclopedias to selling some pretty ethically unsound products. Brianna, you wrote in The Intercept about the class politics of the film. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was great. And with all of the absurdity of the film, the sci-fi aspects, the kind of cartoonish, colorful clothes and hair and set and outrageous conceits, the most revolutionary and striking aspect of the film from my perspective are absolutely the politics and the simple fact that we're watching a movie in 2018 that's not been marketed as a political film, that's coming across as kind of like a fun pop culture comedy romp, that at its center, almost as a protagonist, is a labor strike. And that in a world where we often have films where people overcome financial hardships or an unfair system by the strength of their own personal grit or just being super intelligent or super wily, here was a film where an entire kind of work community was able to elevate themselves by working together and using tools that are actually at our disposal, that tool being collective action.
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised. I purposely did not read anything about the film before I saw it. I just had, you know, heard it was really good and that it was kind of surprising. And so I went into it not knowing much. And I did not expect it to be so political and was pleasantly surprised. And also, I just love Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson, who are, you know, two of the starring actors in the film. I thought they were great. And I would be curious to hear what you guys thought about Tessa Thompson's role. She plays Detroit, who's the, you know, romantic foil to the main character, Cash, played by Lakeith Stanfield. Rachel, did you have any thoughts on her? You just saw it last night.
I absolutely love Tessa Thompson, and I loved her in this movie. I wore earrings today to kind of channel her vibe, but I had to take them off because the headphones made my ears hurt. But I feel like
I always feel like I'm about to get in a fight when I put on the headphones in the studio because I'm like taking my earrings off.
Same, ready to fight the patriarchy or something. But I really loved her in this movie, and I really love that kind of one of the messages of the movie was that art without action isn't really saying anything. And so the fact that Detroit not only had this performance artist vibe and had her like studio voice and the British accent that she put on, which I wasn't entirely sure what the purpose of that was, but she was involved in direct action continually throughout the movie.
Yeah, I think the British accent was her white voice. Yeah, some of the, just, you know, for listeners who haven't seen the movie yet, the telemarketers who are black are encouraged to put on a white voice to make the people that they're calling feel like, oh, the person who's talking to me is just like me, or someone I would want to be, you know, somebody who's like carefree and has a lot of money and isn't like desperate to sell me this thing. And I feel like when she put on her British accent when she's talking to, you know, art dealers or whoever comes to her show, that's her doing the same thing that the other folks were doing in their telemarketing lives.
Yeah, in some ways, I felt like her storyline, I really enjoy Tessa Thompson as well, but I felt like her storyline and her character is probably one of the less developed aspects of a very good film, regardless. I've heard Boots Riley, who wrote the film, say in interviews that he felt like her character was the one that was closest to himself. And I've also heard him say, you know, that he has, you know, wrestled with the goals of political art and how he feels like art is empty if it does not connect with a movement and actually connect with action. And it seemed like the film was making some kind of commentary on Tessa Thompson's art and perhaps saying that it was too detached from action insofar as it seemed kind of random, and it was unclear how I was supposed to feel about her live performance, her performance art piece. And her boyfriend, you know, they were broken up at the time in the movie, but the Cassius Green character steps in during that scene and tries to tell her she's getting taken advantage of. People are encouraged to throw things at her during this scene while she recites a line from classic black film, The Last Dragon. And he steps in and it's like, they're debasing you. You shouldn't do this. And she persists and gets through it. And the movie never really explained how I'm supposed to feel about that. Was Cassius right? Was she being debased? Or was that something that, did she have a political purpose that just wasn't clear to me? Her other art in the film, where she was kind of doing guerrilla street art, seemed a lot more purposeful and in line with, I think, what Boots Riley wants from his own art in terms of engaging more directly with politics. I don't know. What did you guys think?
I feel like the audience not being able to get a full direction from what her actual performance art is supposed to be saying might be intentional, and that, yeah, the guerrilla street art made sense in terms of a political movement. But with her performance art and kind of the big murals of Africa, it doesn't really seem to speak to a purpose. And that is kind of what a lot of art that is theoretically political kind of feels like to me. And I feel like that if this is the character that Boots Riley most connects to, I think it makes sense that he himself is not entirely sure what the purpose of our art in this context is supposed to be, if he himself doesn't know what his art divorced from a political context is supposed to be.
Yeah, her performance art piece, I was like almost a direct knockoff, I think, of a Marina Abramović performance art piece where she gave audience members, or like set out a bunch of items and was like, you know, do anything you'd like to do to me with these items. And I think one of them was a loaded gun. I read an interview with Tessa Thompson where she's like, oh, yeah, I love Marina Abramović, blah, blah, blah. It seemed like a pretty direct call out to that. But I agree with you, Brianna, that I feel like her character was really underdeveloped. And it kind of disturbed me. Whatever message that her character arc was trying to send, I think, was pretty twisted, just to spoil a little bit of the film, she starts out as a girlfriend to Cassius Green. She gets less interested in him as he becomes a little bit more exploitative in his job. And she's getting more involved in this radical social movement and the union organizing. And then she leaves him for the union organizer briefly and then gets back with him when he wises up and joins the movement. And it kind of felt to me like this maybe a self-serving message, but regardless, a very twisted message of like women will only have sex with you when you're woke, or like women are this prize that you win for joining the revolution. And like, don't you want to be part of the crew where you'll get to sleep with Tessa Thompson? Otherwise, she'll leave you for the more radical dude.
Yeah, I definitely felt like the ending, like that would have been the implication less if she had just stuck with Steven Yeun's character, the organizer's right. character at the end. It wasn't, I did not understand why she went back to Cassius, because it really did feel like a present for waking up.
And I don't know, I felt like they kind of outsourced a lot of her, what should have been her personality, to her clothes and makeup. I mean, mm-hmm. they were so outlandish and really fun to look at. And I kind of found myself thinking like, oh, could I do that? Like, could I put some eyeliner right under my eyebrow, you know, and would that look cool? And I know like The Cut at New York Magazine I just saw did a piece about how to get her makeup looks. And now on the Sorry to Bother You website, they're selling the earrings she wears in the show or in the movie where that she makes herself. It's part of her art. And they're selling a version of the plate that Cash snorts, quote unquote, cocaine off of. And it, I don't know, that the whole commercialization of the aesthetics of the film, it feels icky to me considering the politics of the film. And I know there's always like going to be some dissonance when you're making commercial anti-capitalist art under capitalism, but I don't know. It seemed particularly egregious to me, especially the fact that they're selling these earrings that she wears, which are almost all sold out, by the way. They're selling many different versions of them. And they're supposed to symbolize this art, which at least some of it is supposed to have this, I interpret it as an incorruptible core, that part of it really does represent who she is and the movement she's trying to make against an exploitative system. I think the murals she does, or the, you know, large scale paintings she does of Africa, I connected that a little bit more with what he ended up doing at the party where he gets all these white people to say the N-word, where, oh, you know, you're watching, when you see a black artist, you expect them to do a specific kind of thing. But the art that she makes for herself, the fact that they're selling that at a gift shop on the website, didn't make me think too highly of the films of, I don't know. I wonder why Boots Riley says, okay, yeah, let's try to make some more money by commercializing the art that this character makes in the film.
Well, he's talked about it and he's self-conscious. I mean, he's self-aware about it. You know, I know that some part of his explanation had to do with feeling like symbols were still powerful as part of a movement, kind of independent of thoughts about art being able to further the movement. But he also said that he always conceptualized the website as part of the movie from its inception for reasons. I don't know. I don't know that I completely bought the reasons, but it wasn't as though he's like, I'm going to make this anti-capitalist film and then completely without, you know, lacking an insight, have this capitalist project over here on the side. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some commentary about the popularity of the site or something that happens after the fact, because even parts of the site are kind of performative. The car that Cassius Green drives in the movie, this kind of rundown old jalopy that he ends up replacing, becomes a symbol of his financial success and also his kind of ethical corruption that comes with that success, is for sale on the website. You can pay $10,000 or whatever for this old car and buy it online. And so there does seem to be this kind of performance art aspect of the website, and I don't know that we know our role in it yet.
All right, that's a good point. And one of the things on the website is a Swell water bottle, or a knockoff of a Swell water bottle, which I think of Swell water bottles as almost like a status symbol at like in workout classes and stuff. You know, it's this really trendy item. And it was just funny for me to see the logo of this movie on this really recognizable sort of branded item.
Wait, what are Swell water bottles?
I feel like you'd recognize them. They're metal and tall. They're kind of ubiquitous now.
Yeah, I think I got one for my old law firm.
They become swag at a lot of things these days, and they keep your cold drinks cold for 24 hours and your hot drinks hot for 12.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do know these. I actually might be carrying one right now, but it's from Target, so I'm different.
What was your take, or, you know, this is for either of you guys. I would love to know your take on the film's depiction of political demonstrations, especially now that we're seeing people who've never been involved in political demonstrations before coming out for things like the Women's March and the March Against Family Separation and things like that.
I think the way that it showed the potential violence of political demonstrations really struck me, in that the really heavily militarized, I guess, SWAT forces, I was very unclear as to whether that was a private police force or the actual government trying to break the strike line. I think the way it showed how protesters try to respond to that violence, and that in the, trying not to spoil as much as possible, but in the end, the ways in which they have to kind of fight force with force is something that you have to do when you're met with military grade weapons.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere on the internet, you'll have to excuse me, there's so much internet, yesterday, where someone was explaining that the word demonstration, that it was initially pegged to the idea that when you amassed in the street in large numbers, you were demonstrating your capacity to shut down labor. And it wasn't supposed to be just a performative or, you know, a kind of a movement for optics. It wasn't just to be there. It was to actually show your power to affect, to disrupt capitalism and to reclaim some power and wages for yourself. And so, you know, I sometimes wonder what the effect of demonstrations that aren't linked to some kind of project like that are. They certainly have a lot of inspirational value. But I contrast, you know, the Women's March, for instance, not to pick on that march in particular, with other kinds of marches. You know, the March on Washington was a march, as a labor march, right? And, you know, we had some demonstrations over the past week in Europe where taxi drivers all parked their cars in single file in major freeways and shut down. They were able to shut down the freeways, right, by just parking and staying there in advocacy for their rights. We had Prime Day here and in Europe simultaneously a series of Amazon strikes. Right. That with that we're done with the focus of affecting Amazon's bottom line and therefore forcing them to provide workers with more rights. And my hope would be that we increasingly have more labor demonstrations that connect the idea of kind of civil disobedience or work stoppages with some concretized or articulable set of rights that people are actually trying to get, as opposed to, I don't want to say that's not useful, but opposed to kind of this disembodied protest, which to me are somewhat analogous to this idea of art that isn't connected to a movement. And so that's why the movie was so powerful to me, because it provided a set of tools for people, an instruction manual for people in a world where labor has been, you know, downplayed by both our democratic political system and kind of our culture compared to what it was in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it's always the question for me, and I think for a lot of people, when there's any sort of march or rally or political demonstration, like, what is the point of it? And I think it can have many different points. It can be, here are all the people who might vote you out of office. Here are all the people who, you know, the public opinion is turning against you on this one issue, and don't you want to be on the right side of public opinion? Also, it could be inspiring for somebody sitting at home and seeing all these people on the news and, perhaps I should look into whatever issue it is that they're demonstrating about. But it does, I feel like now that political demonstrations under Trump have become sort of a given, now it's more about, like, what are the funny signs from this rally? Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of news outlets, Slate included, will do a slideshow or a roundup of all the best signs from a demonstration, which speaks to your point, Brianna, that it is a sort of art and performance art. And I know one of the interviews that I read with Boots Riley, he talked about the idea of lowered expectations. So now our expectations when we demonstrate are not that let's change the system, it's let's change the arbiters of the system. Mm-hmm. And so our expectations now are so low that it's stop putting children in cages. Mm-hmm. Not even all children. Stop putting this specific set of children in cages. We're not even talking about, like, you know, the juvenile justice system or anything. It's, oh, let's get someone in office who doesn't put a child in baby jail. Right. And honestly, that's why I didn't love the, I'm not going to say what it is, but the, I guess, deus ex machina at the end of the film, where it's not something that I think could happen in real life. And so what the instruction manual you're talking about, Brianna, I think was sort of sold out at the end.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, again, if we're trying not to spoil it, I mean, the idea that there are, let's say, violent means that end up accompanying the labor strike, that there is like physical force that ends up getting involved at a certain point is very much a possibility. And it's a possibility that becomes more probable the more exploitation occurs. And at the end of the film, you know, we discover that the corporation that's promoted our protagonist and has also, you know, kept all the strikers, you know, kind of exploited, is doing something that is way worse beyond our imagination. And, you know, that kind of the, you know, the kind of violence that they've done to people in the context of the film might very well, if something analogous happened in real life, provoke that kind of insurrection, shall we say. I don't know if that's so improbable. Obviously, the sci-fi aspect of it is improbable. But the idea that there it might come to a point where there is armed conflict, I think that that's kind of like the history of revolution. It's certainly the history of our nation. And you know, our founding fathers didn't actually anticipate that we would have gone so long without some kind of likely violent revolution. And that's not a call to arms. That's just saying that, you know, the threat of violence is very real in the movie, you know, as Rachel was saying, from the police force who was breaking the strike, et cetera. And, you know, it is likely that, you know, violence will be a part of any revolution that genuinely tries to attack the roots of capital. I don't mean to sound so.
Yeah, no.
Antifa, I definitely, that's just how it is.
Yeah, no, I feel that. I remember when, just to pick on the Women's March a little bit more, when that happened, a lot of the praise afterwards was that it was nonviolent and that no one got arrested and that the police were there and their pink pussy hats. And it just, And so I think that the divorce of political movements from the threat of violence, not just from the people who are protesting, but from the state in general, is a huge shift that has happened in a lot of protests under Trump, where these protests are organized and they have permits and no one's getting arrested. And it feels like if there's no threat to the state and there's no threat of state violence, what actually are we doing other than kind of giving each other a space to yell, which is important, but is kind of divorced from a political goal in general.
Listeners, I would love to know what y'all thought of the film, especially the depictions of political demonstrations and Tessa Thompson's character in particular. You can email thewaves@slate.com with your thoughts. Our second topic for today, the criminalization of mothers who leave their kids alone. Kim Brooks wrote a piece for the New York Times last week about the time she left her four-year-old in a locked car in a parking lot for 5 minutes on a cloudy 50-degree day. Someone was watching her, recorded her son, recorded her coming back to the car, and called the police. She was then charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. She originally wrote about this in Salon in 2014, but for her recent piece, she spoke to several mothers who had also been charged with crimes for similar actions or harassed by the police for either leaving their kids in the car, letting them walk outside alone. And one of the most galling parts of this to me, and I know this has been something that sort of comes up in cycles in the media, often around summer, which is when a lot of parents accidentally leave their kids in the car. Not a lot. I'll say I think there's something like 30 to 40 kids die every year being left in cars. This often happens in the summer when cars overheat. Around that time, I feel like this other narrative sort of comes around about parents who leave their kids in a car in a not dangerous situation and bystanders end up calling the police. And one of the most galling parts of that to me is just the instinct to call the police as the first response instead of making sure the child is okay, or in addition to making sure the child is okay. And in the case of Kim Brooks, which is what she writes about in the New York Times, you know, the person video recorded her coming back to the car and knew that she was only gone for a couple minutes. And it was sort of creepy for her to imagine this person sort of circling her car, looking in the window at her son, who is 4 years old, you know, old enough to know that something's going on. And even after she knew that the kid was okay, called the cops on Kim Brooks. And it's not in the best interest of the child in the vast majority of cases to call the police. I mean, some of the kids in the cases that we've heard about in the past, kids get put in foster care. And if you think a kid is, you know, more at risk of harm being left in a car for a couple minutes than being put for weeks or months in foster care, I think, you know, you don't know a thing about child development. And the relative risk here, I think, is sort of gets lost when somebody makes that decision to call the police. What do you guys think?
I think that the bystander aspect of it reminded me of a lot of stories that have come out recently with like Permit Patty or Coupon Dan, of people just calling police for reasons that, like, there's no law being broken. It's just some generally white person feeling like they really just need to step in and do something. And in this scenario, leaving your kid in a car for a few minutes while you run in and get a coffee is like, your kid's going to be crying in Starbucks. Everyone gets annoyed when kids cry in Starbucks, but then they also call police when you leave them in the car. So there's no middle ground here.
Yeah, there's a world in which we have a different relationship with the police, both communities of color in particular, but society at large, that wouldn't make it so that calling in the police presents such a threat of violence to the people involved, and that it didn't operate as a kind of tax on the poor, the way that, you know, bail operates and the way that the legal system operates, such that having resources and ability to afford an attorney really significantly changes your chances at having a successful outcome. You know, one woman who was written about in one of these articles was a public defender, and she was very self-aware about the fact that she's a white woman, a public defender, and was able to talk herself out of harsher penalties when the cops were called on her for leaving her child in the car. But knowing that that's not the relationship that most of us have with the police, there is a kind of cluelessness involved when folks think they're doing more harm or less harm, rather, by calling them in than letting things be. And so part of the problem here is not just that they're these individual actors, because hypothetically, there's a world in which the police are actually helpful and good, and they show up, they just look around, they get the kid out if they need to get out, they just patiently wait and keep an eye out on things while the mom comes back and says, hey, have a good day, I hope you enjoy your latte. And it wouldn't be an issue, but the underlying concern here in some ways is our kind of exploitative and militarized police state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where it doesn't actually have to do with public safety. It has to do with punishment.
Right.
And the study, Kim Brooks talks about this study in the piece that she wrote. It was a study performed, I think it was in 2016, where scientists at UC Irvine showed a bunch of people these scenarios, various scenarios where a parent left a kid unattended, and the subjects, the people in the study, had to assess how much danger the kid was in. Sometimes it was the kid was accidentally left because the parent, you know, was, for example, hit by a car. In some instances, it was that the child was left alone on purpose because the parent had to go to work or had plans with a friend or something like that. And the researchers found that the people in the study believed that the kids were more at risk or less at risk based on why the parent was gone. So it wasn't just the fact that the parent was gone that determined whether or not they thought the kid was at danger. It was if the parent was gone for some reason that the parent couldn't help, like if the parent, you know, was harmed, then they wouldn't think the kid was as in much danger as if the parent made the decision to leave the child alone. I think that sort of speaks to the idea that people want to punish parents more for their decisions, or believe that if somebody does something immoral, whether or not that puts their child at risk, that they deserve to be punished for that decision.
I think one of the striking things about that study was that those results seem to only apply to mothers. Fathers, when they looked at fathers, people rated the child in equal danger, whether the father intentionally left the child or accidentally left the child, which really seems to show that this kind of weird morality is only intended to punish women and mothers specifically.
Yeah.
I also thought about the free range kids movement. And to me, when I hear about whatever free range kids situation, like, oh, you know, parents like to let their kids be alone. They think it's good for their kids' development to have unsupervised play. I think of, you know, really bougie communities and like, you know, rich folks in Berkeley or something like that. They have this idea, like they probably use, you know, cloth diapers and like, I don't know, it's a stereotype I have in my head of a parent who would do that on purpose versus the parent who maybe needs to go into a job interview and doesn't have childcare and so leaves the kids in the car for like maybe half an hour or an hour or at home alone or something like that. It's like a necessity versus a choice. And in some cases, those people get penalized in equal measure. I think in different communities, it probably works differently. It also depends on who's surveilling you. Is it the cops getting involved or is it a bystander who may just judge you or may actually call the cops on you? But I think there's also different expectations for those two different types of parents for what they should or shouldn't be doing with their children, and also, you know, whether they're unfit parents or not.
Yeah, that raises another structural issue, which is if there were universal free childcare, for instance, then we wouldn't have to have the same level of debate of are they doing this? Are they having free range children? Because they, you know, the free range children people, we would know that that was as voluntary as the people who left their the lower income people who leave their kids for jobs, right? Like they, you know, you wouldn't have a situation where people are kind of forced to leave their kids and everyone would kind of be on the same platform of if a child is being unsupervised, it's because it's a purposeful choice and we can kind of judge all these people similarly. And perhaps there'd be fewer people who did or who would leave their kids free range in a safer kind of more like a supervised environment that would incur less judgment from the public.
Do you guys remember being left in the cars alone? I remember all the time as a kid being like sitting with my little book or whatever in a car. And I kind of, you know, I don't feel like I'm from that much of a different world or generation than the kids that we're talking about now. I mean, I know a lot of the people who write these stories are a little bit older than me. And so I'm like, oh, maybe it really was like, oh, kids used to walk to and from school 3 miles each way and whatever. But, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, I feel like it was a normal thing to leave your kids in the car, or at least my parents did it. And I wasn't abducted.
Yeah, I think it was too. Like, what I remember, if I remember it, I was old enough that I feel like it's a non-issue. Like, are people really mad about, like, seven-year-olds being left in cars? Or are they only really mad about three-year-olds being left in cars?
Yeah, and I think, honestly, I think that's a little bit of a subjective difference. Or, you know, where do you draw the line? Where is the line, oh, a kid could scream if they were getting abducted? Or find their way out of the car if they were getting too hot? I feel like it's not, if you're trying to make a law about it or something, it's really hard to know where to draw that line. And actually, Utah recently did pass a law that says, you know, children whose needs are being met and who are of a sufficient age that they can get themselves out of risk of harm, then yes, it's okay to leave them alone. But how do you tell if a kid is old enough and mature enough to keep themselves out of harm's way?
I don't know, man. I saw that YouTube clip of that little baby like frying up food on a skillet. And I think in Asia somewhere.
Wait, was that?
Yeah, there's this like viral YouTube clip of this little like 2-year-old like deep frying food in this like low silver wok like pan close to the ground. And you know, they were really cooking up good looking stuff. I mean, they were supervised, but yeah, they were handling it. I don't know.
Yeah. Kids are incredible. Yeah, it's so subjective with what different kids, I guess, can do. And I guess that's what leaves the law up to such wild interpretation, where it's like, who's deciding that this child's sufficient needs are being met? What does that mean?
Yeah.
How is that defined?
And also, what sort of needs arise when you're 5 minutes in the store?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm glad we're talking about this because I've been thinking a lot about the everyday separations, the threat that comes that is presented to children who are, because of these kinds of interventions, put in foster care, separated from their parents because of their parents are caught up in the criminal justice system, and kind of the different level of attention and concern about those separations and the effects on those children versus the conversation that very rightly is happening about the children who are caught up with ICE at the border. And I hope that conversation about ICE percolates to these other parts of our community, because this the same sorts of damage that's happening to children there. I mean, there have been a lot of stories in the last week or so about children reunited with their parents whose personalities are different, or who are angry at their parents because they were told that their parents didn't want them and were somehow participants in the separation, you know, and the long-term psychological effects of these kinds of things. I mean, there are kids, obviously, who are subjected to those kinds of harms every day in the course of the criminal justice system, sometimes because of these kinds of interventions. So it's good to keep an open mind about the fact that you know, what's happening at the border isn't an isolated occurrence.
Yeah.
And I think the point that, you know, any time in the foster care system or separated from a parent, you know, in cases that aren't actual abuse and neglect, is damaging to a kid. I think that's something that gets erased in a lot of discussions of these sort of routine separations of kids and parents, that it's not a neutral act to say, oh, let's just get the kids out of this home for a short period of time and then they'll be, you know, right back with their parents if everything's okay. That short period of time has lasting impact on a kid's psyche.
Oh, I was just going to say that growing up, I think I was on the edge of a lot of the helicopter parenting that's happening right now, like with TV, where a lot of news of abduction kind of made parents more protective. But my mom would use like the CPS and potentially getting separated from me as kind of like a threat for why I couldn't do certain
wow.
things. Just because, I mean, I was a Black child and I went to school in like Indiana, and the threat of me looking like I was neglected for any reason was something that she was very cognizant of. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's something that a lot of kids do grow up with, that they do know that getting separated from their parents is a very real possibility.
Yeah. Listeners, if you have any stories about being harassed by the police for leaving a kid in a car, or if you have opinions about whether parents should be leaving their kids alone in the car, email us at thewaves@slate.com. And if you have good responses, we'll talk about them on the next episode. All right, our last topic for today, Nia Wilson. Two Sundays ago, this 18-year-old young Black woman was standing on a BART platform. That's the Bay Area Rapid Transit train. She was with two of her sisters. She was stabbed in the neck and killed, and one of her sisters was injured. Rachel, I know her murder has been all over the media in the past week and a half. Can you give us just a little recap on what happened, what people are talking about?
Definitely. So a lot of the organizing around Nia's death has taken place under the Say Her Name hashtag, which was created about 3 years ago to kind of bring stories of women, Black women's experience with anti-Black violence to the forefront. And so there's no clear motive in the attack against Nia, in that obviously he did not yell the N-word or, you know, call her a bitch or anything. But her sister feels like it was racially motivated, and a lot of people organizing for her feel like it was racially motivated because the man who attacked her was white. And so Anne Hathaway posted under the Say Her Name hashtag. Brittany Packett, one of the activists who's been really involved in this kind of activism, has posted under this hashtag. And people are kind of really calling on the police to say that it's a hate crime, and there's really no way to know if it is, but this attack very much fits into kind of a long cycle of attacks of Black women and young women being attacked or killed or beaten for objectively no reason, either saying no to a man or just because a man feels like it. It comes about 3 months after the Toronto van attack, when someone who claimed he was involuntarily celibate decided to kill 10 people because he felt like he couldn't get laid. And so this death plays into a lot of fear and anxiety that Black women and women in general have, where there's no way to stop it. It feels, it's very random, but it also feels part of a larger system.
Yeah, the discussions about, you know, men or feelings of fear that women endure walking in public rung true to me, especially because it's summer, which for me is the season of the highest levels of street harassment. And I feel like, you know, walking outside, I have a couple tattoos. Sometimes it'll be like people compliment my tattoos. I'll say thank you and humor them. And then it turns into a sexual harassment situation of like, oh, and I like everything else going on in your body, too. And things like that. And it's like a constant calculation that I feel like I'm going through in my mind about I want to be sassy to this person or insult them or, you know, make them feel as uncomfortable as they just made me. But, you know, I don't know what their motives are and will they follow me? And am I alone right now? It's like a split second calculation. And I imagine in this environment where white supremacist groups have been encouraged and emboldened by people, you know, all the way up to the White House, it's, you know, for Black women and other women of color, it's probably a whole nother set of calculations.
Yeah, the question of whether or not it's a hate crime is an interesting one to me. You know, hate establishing hate crimes has been a question that I've, you know, been concerned with for a while. It came up in an episode that we did on Spodi about free speech. And, you know, if you're basically relying on these outward expressions to get to what a person's intent was, it seems like kind of an impossible task, which then leads me to ask kind of what do we want out of it being called a hate crime? Do we want some recognition that there are ways in which Black people are uniquely victimized because of our race? I think that that's it. And part of what's going on there is this kind of history of under prosecution for crimes. And, you know, the Say Your Name hashtags and the Black Lives Matter hashtags are largely about not just the fact of the violence, but the fact that it's not addressed by the criminal justice system in the in an equal way that that justice is sought for white victims, shall we say. And charges are brought against the perpetrators of violence against white victims. You know, the, there's stats like, you know, you're four times more likely to get the death penalty if your victim was white versus black. Right. So we know that we live in that kind of world. And that's why we say Black Lives Matter, because the criminal justice system does not reflect that they do. So in a case like this, where the person is caught after a little delay, but was caught and is likely to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, I'm curious about whether or not that, you know, mediates against the need at all to call it, to find it a hate crime, and whether or not, you know, that that helps, or if there's still some kind of community need to say that this particular instance, as opposed to society and a whole, was reflective of racism.
Yeah, I feel like the designation of hate crime, I do agree, because he has been, I feel like he might, is going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. I don't know why I have hope for that, but I do in this specific case. I feel
Anne
like
Hathaway
hate crime,
got involved.
Yeah, you know, you know? That important hashtag. I just feel like in this case, the added charge of hate crime is just feels like it's going to be reparative for a lot of people, and that it is the acknowledgement that this would be, this was a race-based attack, or this is an attack more likely to happen to Black women. I don't really know what the utility of it is, or if they would even be able to prosecute that or prove that, and if that would actually hurt their case if they added it on. But I can understand why people want them to do so.
The police are saying things like, oh, well, he wasn't a member of any white supremacist groups. And like you said, Rachel, he didn't, you know, scream a racial slur while he was on the platform. And the it's, you know, those two things aren't necessary for somebody to have racial motivations for a physical or verbal attack. And the question of whether it what is the utility of a hate crime designation reminded me of a story I covered last summer, the murder of Nabra Hassanin, who was a 17-year-old Muslim girl in Reston, Virginia, who was walking with a bunch of friends really late at night, or really early in the morning, actually, to get a meal before the fast began that day for Ramadan. And there was a little bit of a verbal back and forth between a man who came up in a car and one of the boys in the group she was with. The man ended up beating and raping and murdering Nabra Hassanin. And when I went to her vigil last summer and interviewed a bunch of people there, it felt like it functioned as a hate crime, even though the police were saying, well, there's no evidence that this was an attack on her because she was Muslim. You know, the Muslim community in Reston, Virginia, and the surrounding area was still filled with fear. And, you know, it was reflective of the hate that they often confront in their everyday lives, you know, and she was wearing an abaya, which is a long religious garment. It's hard to say what, it's hard to pick apart, I think, what somebody's motives were when it's very clear that the victim was Muslim, and we live in an Islamophobic society. I think of the Pulse massacre too. You know, there's no evidence that Omar Mateen, who killed 49 people at a gay club on Latin night in Orlando, Florida, was motivated to go to that club because it was gay and because it was Latin night. But the gay community still felt fear because of it. And, you know, he was homophobic. Like there was evidence of him cheering on ISIS, which murders gay people. ISIS congratulated him for murdering all these people. His dad said that he was really angered when he saw two men kissing in front of his wife and kid. And it's, if something functions as a hate crime, you know, after that massacre, I remember going to gay bars and gay events, and everyone like would be on and off feeling on edge. I think that the actually calling it a hate crime or proving somehow that somebody had the intent to target somebody because of a specific identity doesn't matter so much. or it doesn't make any concrete difference whether or not the intention was there if a community ends up feeling like they're being targeted.
Yeah, I think for lesser crimes, crimes, you know, that aren't murder, because I mean, if you murder someone or many people, it's not your life sentence isn't really affected by the extent to which you get it's ratcheted up because it's a hate crime. You're in jail forever. That is what it is. It's some of these cases. I think the reason why this kind of hate crime law was instituted is, you know, if you're running around beating up Black people in 1965 and you're trying to terrorize a community, you know, the penalty for beating someone up, getting in a bar fight, punching someone on the street might not be high enough to prevent you from going around doing it, particularly if you live in a community that's going to let you off the hook from doing it because they're similarly racist and you have a jury of your racist peers. But if, you know, there is a law that says if you punch someone and you do it because you're Black, you could be in jail for 10 years or whatever it is, then that changes the calculation. So in these instances, you know, there is an extent to which it does feel like a little bit of a moot point. But the other purpose of hate crime laws is to say there are communities which are particularly vulnerable to violence and we want them to be protected. So, you know, there's added penalties for killing a judge, right? For killing a cop. There's a kind of hate crime legislation around those groups because they're already perceived to be vulnerable because they are, you know, putting themselves in harm's way if they're a cop or because they're ruling on cases with mafia figures and, you know, people who could want to seek retribution. So the question then is also, you know, do we just want to have a blanket rule that because certain groups are so vulnerable, if anybody does anything to them, they should go to jail for an extra long time? And that might feel somewhat overly broad, but I think that's the right framework to be thinking about these things in. As a former lawyer,
I think that framework would do a lot to, I guess, the thing about these crimes that make them feel so fraught for me, especially, is that there's nothing preventing it from happening. If it's not going to get prosecuted as a hate crime, besides the fact that he's going to go to jail forever, what really is stopping this from happening again? And the fact that crimes against Black people aren't prosecuted as often, really, just like, this feels like a case out of many that is actually going to end up like resulting in someone getting punished for it. And so I think that that framework where it's like these groups are particularly vulnerable and like a crime against them should be considered like particularly malicious would actually go further than whatever the hate crime legislation is, because it's so hard to prove.
Yeah. Look like a Brock Turner situation where, you know, he has, you know, attempted to rape this woman behind a dumpster. He gets a slap on the wrist. Every conversation is about how he's a fantastic swimmer at Stanford and not about this horrible thing that he's done. You know, in a world where hypothetically any sexual violence against a woman had a minimum sentence. I mean, there's certain sex pornography crimes that are treated that way, right? With minimum sentences. But, you know, I also just want to push back against that because we do live in a system of overcriminalization. And I think the goal shouldn't be to get more people in jail. It's just that we want an equitable application of these kinds of sentences across the board. And we have to be really careful that our goal isn't to over incarcerate more in an eye for an eye sort of way. That's not what justice looks like.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's proven that anytime there's any sort of minimum sentencing or extra prosecution of a certain class of crimes, that it's always marginalized communities that suffer worst for it. And so, and I'm not sure if that's true with the extra years that would get put onto your sentence for a hate crime designation. But, you know, I think that if I'm always hesitant to push for extra years in prison for anybody, because I think that it's always the people who are already getting screwed by the system who are going to pay for that. So I feel like even just an acknowledgement from, I don't know, political leaders, from police officers or the chief of police in this situation, that this has had, that the murder of Nia Wilson has had a disproportionate effect on the Black community in Oakland, and maybe across the country, would do just as much, if not more, than, you know, tacking some extra years onto this guy's sentence. I know that's at least in, when the Pulse massacre happened, I know that the feeling that Republicans were refusing to say that the gay community and the Latino community in Orlando was the one were targeted and disproportionately suffering for this was the thing that people were objecting to more so than, oh, you know, did this guy really hate gay people enough to want to kill them because they were gay?
Yeah.
I think we also need to think about, yeah, especially going beyond a criminal justice framework, what are we teaching boys and what, how do we stop this from happening, not by putting people in jail, but by stopping just the intent behind it? And I feel like that's something that's come up a lot in the aftermath of Me Too, where people have realized that this is a wide-scale problem. But what exactly are we teaching boys, and how are we going to stop doing that?
Yeah, especially with so many people who are connected to the, you know, incel movement. And, you know, I remember when Elliot Rodgers happened years ago now, being completely caught up in reading his manifesto, because it seemed like the psychology of what was motivating him was so, like, obvious and just there on its face, and that there were all these things going on with him that were this perfect storm of anger that would be externalized against women. And it does, when someone's kind of psychology is so obvious, it does kind of make you want to intervene. You know, it seems like there are things that can be done. But in, you know, in the Nia Wilson situation, the man was schizophrenic, right? And so there's not, you know, the vast majority of people with mental illness obviously do not commit crimes. So, you know, that's not the issue, but there, you know, there is an issue here of, you know, the guy couldn't get proper medical care. There was not, there's not an institutional, there's not institutional support the way there should be for people with mental health issues. Like, that's a huge part of what is actually going on here, almost probably more so than the criminal justice piece in this particular story.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to some recommendations. Rachel, what do you have for us?
So I almost rethought this in the light of Sorry to Bother You and how they portrayed reality television, but I am going to recommend my favorite summer guilty pleasure, which is a reality television show called Are You the One?
I feel like I can write the script for that show without even knowing what it's about.
Probably. I think it fundamentally gets to the kind of emptiness of all dating shows like The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. But basically, there are 24 very attractive singles in a house somewhere on a beach, and matchmakers have matched them. So each person in the house has a perfect match. And so they have to find their perfect match by the end of the 10 weeks. And then they win $1 million. And so
they're correct.
If they're correct. But they have to get all of the matches correctly. If they don't, so they have to do a matchup ceremony. And for example, if there are no matches like once a week, then their prize gets cut in half. So I feel like this really shows, like with The Bachelorette, it's talking about love and all this stuff, but it's really a prize game at the end of the storyline. And so I really feel like Are You the One really gets to the emptiness of that. And it's honestly just very fun to watch. And there are seasons where they just don't win the money. And it's after 10 weeks, it's somehow funnier that they just don't win the money after spending like the past 10 weeks. Because there are couples that just refuse to break up, even though they know they're not a match. It's a lot.
Aww.
There's
something
called the Boom Boom Room. It's just...
Oh, of course there is.
I love it.
And what happens in the Boom Boom Room? I can't
exactly
even imagine
what it sounds like. It is just where couples go to have a night alone because they all sleep on mattresses on the floor in this like one... Listen.
Oh, man. The budget for this.
The budget's not very high, but it's on MTV, and I think it comes back towards the end of August, but I would 10 out of 10 recommend watching this show.
Wow. Sometimes I feel like reality shows are just like, it's just fun to watch people get tortured a little bit. Like, oh, these people all have to sleep on a mattress on the floor and find their, and, you know, decide what a bunch of producers thought they would want in a mate.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very Sorry to Bother You, mm-hmm. where the reality show is people getting the literal shit kicked out of them.
All right. I we'll probably not check that out, but I would love to hear you talk more about it. My recommendation is something that I wanted to review on this show and I got voted down. I'm recommending Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. It's the sequel to Mamma Mia, whatever, one, which I think was about, came out a decade ago. This one finds Amanda Seyfried still on her Greek island trying to reopen a hotel. We find out that Meryl Streep's character, her mom, has died, which I didn't realize Meryl Streep wasn't really going to be a big character in the movie, so that was an initial disappointment. Yeah. And honestly, there's plenty to criticize about this movie, but I'm not going to because this is a recommendation. I had so much fun watching this movie. It's some of it, you know, because it's, there's like a couple funny things that happen in the movie, but mostly it was just me laughing at how ridiculous and dumb the movie was. There's a whole scene where there's, you know, a song and dance happening in one area and then a flashback happening at the same time of somebody literally giving birth, like in conjunction with the song and dance. Like a really intimate portrayal of childbirth happening in the context of a feel-good musical. There's a really cool depiction of how people's romantic exes get along or interact with each other, which I think is very strange for a straight romance, where there's these three men who were both exes of the Meryl Streep character, who looms large in the film, though she's barely in it. And the three of them in their old age become best friends and just sort of bro out together. And it felt very gay to me, representative of like how gay friendships work. And I don't think I've ever seen a straight movie be like, oh, we all slept with the same woman. Cool. Like, let's all be friends. I also just loved sitting in a chair and looking at beautiful ocean scenes and listening to people's bad singing voices. Pierce Brosnan sings and he's so bad.
So oh, bad. No.
I was hoping he wouldn't sing in the second
bad
one.
He is. It's so good. Colin Firth, who I feel like plays the same character in every movie,
he does.
Plays that character in this movie and it just wins me over every time. So I'm just going to say, go get stoned if that's your thing and watch Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
I just actually watched the first one for the first time a couple of weeks ago. You know how all of the streaming networks, like they put the things in front of you when there's a new version coming out.
Oh, yeah.
And it was entertaining. Apart from, I love Pierce Brosnan. I was a Remington Steele girl. That was a show from the 70s or maybe 80s that they used to play because I used to live abroad where they would play old TV all the time. And I grew up absolutely loving it and loving him. And I think he's the best Bond. Don't at me. but a singing voice sucks. My recommendation, I feel like I have to get in here that there are a lot of really interesting congressional races happening around the country.
Wait, and you're going to recommend a congressional race?
I feel like I have to point to also gubernatorial races that are happening. It's a very, like, look, we just talked about all of these issues that have all these structural components, right? We talked about criminal justice reform. We talked about bail issues. We talked about the need for free child, universal child care. You know, we talked about labor rights. Like all of these, even the pop culture are things that we talk about, intersect with all of these political concerns that we actually do have some control over right now because we have all these elections coming up. So, you know, we talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez last time I was here, but she's not the only exciting kind of young progressive candidate. If that's what your politics are, I would suggest reading some of the great coverage of Abdullah Saeed's race, who's running for governor of Michigan, along with other people who you should check out and find out about them to see if they better accord with your politics. I'm going to remain neutral on that. And from a pop culture perspective, I would say that I love Glow. I've been really enjoying this new season. Last summer, I had a Glow-themed birthday party because that's how into it I am. And I wanted to wear a unitard.
Did you dress up as a specific character or just a general lady wrestler?
I was the Soviet character. I went to the Army surplus store and got a little, like, hat. You know, like the little, like, kind of sailor hat thing, but with a little red star on the front. and had a red bathing suit that I had bought from one of those Fashion Nova type places that I didn't realize was a thong, so I could never wear it as an actual bathing suit. But I wore it over like tights and it became my Halloween costume and it was awesome. And the new season is great. Yeah.
All right. That's a great recommendation. I'm glad that you did high and low brow, Rihanna. That's our show for today. Thank you to our producer, Danielle Hewitt, and our production assistant, Alex Barish. Thank you so much for listening. For Rachel Hampton and Brianna Joy Gray, I'm Christina Cotterucci.